Good morning.
I'll open the Subcommittee on Natural Resources for March 18th, 2015, and open a public hearing on 5027. My understanding is we got through page 23 of the presentation yesterday, and we will start off with key performance measures. Please proceed.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Devlin, members, again, Jim Rue and Carrie McLaren for the department. Just want to take you back to this slide that we started with yesterday. So we are on day two, and today it would be our proposal to do key performance measures, the 10% reduction option, our policy option packages, our legislative proposals, and then there are some details of the budget that would remain, just some of the minor administrative portions of it, and then we would be done. I would suspect that we will be coming in somewhere around an hour or less, but okay. That obviously is dependent upon how many questions Senator Hansel has for us. So with that, I want to turn it over to Carrie to talk about key performance measures.
So this slide is simply an overview of the approved key performance measures for the department. You can see that we're measuring things such as, that are really critical to the outcomes of our planning program: employment land supply, housing land supply, public facilities plans. We hit on that a lot yesterday. Certified industrial sites, transit supportive land use, transportation planning. Do we have funding and facilities planned for in communities? Protection of our farm and forest land base for commercial production, urban growth boundaries, the grant awards that we do. The part I would key out just as we begin talking about these is that really the first 12 or numbers 1 through 12 that are up there on the screen, we end up using proxies for how we measure that, because really it's the local governments, of course, that do the transit supportive land use planning in their local communities. We provide technical assistance, planning assistance to do that, other encouragement, grant funding resources, but we're using sort of that second tier proxy as the measurement. It's the best measurement we have, but I just wanted to sort of introduce that at the outset. Mixed results, and we'll talk about some of the reasons why. 7 of our 12 measures are met. Many that aren't met we're close on, and so I think that shows some progress in those areas. As I touched upon before, most results reflect a county or city activity, so that's how we're sort of using by proxy what is being accomplished at the local level. And I think the challenges here are very much the same challenges that we talked about yesterday. Limited local and state resources, including grant availability. Our general fund grants have gotten smaller over time in terms of what we're able to give to communities, and not surprisingly, I think as a consequence, the amount of local activity in those long-range planning areas have been more constrained. We also have made some changes. In 2007, the legislature adopted some changes to the threshold for cities required to go through periodic review. Periodic review is the process by which local governments are compelled to update their comprehensive plans and bring them to a new sort of 20-year horizon. The old threshold for cities going through a periodic review was 2,500. It's now been increased to 10,000, and so I think that has some impacts in terms of funding that's available and also the sort of trigger for local governments doing that work. Getting into the meat of the results, employment, this we lumped these three key performance measures that really have to do with employment land planning, housing, industrial siting. Those are metrics for land supply in each one of those subject matter areas. Our target, if we talk about employment land supply, our target for cities that have an up-to-date planning for their employment lands is 75%. And when we look at those cities, our metric asks us to use the old periodic review standard, so that 2,500. If we look at cities greater than 2,500 that have evaluated and updated their employment land supply in the last 10 years, 50% of the communities have done that. That's below our target. If we look, though, at those communities that are required to do periodic review and therefore have a trigger to do that update, so those cities that are larger than 10,000, our numbers are 63%. And I just think that's important to reflect how we measure this. We are asking for a modification to bring our methodology in line with the periodic review requirements. Because we are using a proxy as this measurement, we think it's appropriate to bring it in line with the 2007 requirements for periodic review.
I just got handed a gavel, so I'm going to use it and ask a question. Never had a gavel before.
All problems will be solved in the next 10 seconds.
But I really did have a question. When you say land for employment, I'm not familiar with that term. What does that mean?
Certainly. So employment lands include both commercial office lands and industrial lands. So we, you know, communities are going to be different in terms of what their employment land base is. And so we clump those together. And local government goes through a process under Goal 9 of updating their economic opportunities analysis, looking in the future for what their opportunities are for economic growth, what their current base is, and then matching land supply vis-a-vis those particular employment sector needs.
And how does that differ then from number 4, the industrial siting? Wouldn't that be a similar?
It is a similar measurement. Sorry, it's not a similar measurement. The facts we're looking at are different, and I'll talk right now about that, although they're both indicators of the larger question of do cities have good and available industrial sites for employment opportunities. And I'll skip to that one because I can go back to housing as the third one. The certified industrial sites, those are the number of industrial sites that are certified as project ready each fiscal year. And that certification process is done by Business Oregon. So that's looking at, it's not exactly synonymous with shovel ready, but those are those sites that have gone through the Oregon Prospector, you know, program or listed online being available and really ready to turn dirt to bring a project. Some of the other, going back to the other employment lands, we require that local governments have a 20-year supply for employment lands. Well, not all of those lands are going to be ready and available online. There's going to be some that are sort of sitting there waiting for that development opportunity. So the number 4, the certified industrial sites, really speaks to those that are essentially ready to turn dirt. Jim.
If you're done with industrial sites, I just wanted to add one additional mention of industrial site readiness programs that we have. And probably the 11 session, Senate Bill 766 was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. And it did a couple of things. It set out areas of regionally significant industrial areas. And we have, over the course of the last now 3 years, been working to bring more sites into that regionally significant industrial area. The reason I'm mentioning it, Senator Hansel, is that we just met a month ago, and we gave that designation to Malheur County, to the three cities of Ontario, Vail, and Nyssa. And what it does is it primarily, it's in many ways a marketing tool, because they can then say, we are a state regionally significant industrial area. What does that mean in terms of real content? It makes available no and low-cost loans to the community, particularly for infrastructure, but also brings other assets to the game. We are waiting for one. It's been in the queue for a while, one from Hermiston. At the interchange that we're looking to add to that list. But it's just one more tool to make available and make known to potential industrial clients that land is ready to go.
Thank you.
And it's one on which I would report for the certified industrial sites. Our target is, again, and this is measuring really kind of work of business, organ, and local governments, but the outcome we desire, seven sites was our target. We actually nine sites were certified during the time period. So I think it's an area of some success. Again, just more tools in a toolbox, but one which we think prepares cities for that economic growth. Housing supply. This key performance measure measures the percent of cities that have an adequate supply of buildable land for housing. Again, the methodology that we use is how many cities have updated their housing needs analyses and plans in the last 10 years. So it's a proxy figure. Again, it's one which really differentiates between whether or not we look at the cities that are greater than 2,500 or the cities that are larger than 10,000. So our target in this arena is 90%. The actual, if we include all cities greater than 2,500, it was only 56%. If we look at the cities larger than 10,000, it's 83%. And I think it just speaks to where our grant funding goes and also what communities are experiencing growth. I think we see more growth in those cities that are larger than 10,000, therefore more need to be looking at and updating their land supplies. A bit about how it's measured. A measurement we don't have, but I think is somewhat relevant to this conversation, is urban growth boundary expansions. And I looked back at some of our statistics for the last 10 years. So from 2004 forward, there have been about 90 urban growth boundary expansions and adjustments in the state, totaling about 13,000 acres, actually a little bit more because we didn't have numbers in some of ourselves. it's split between industrial housing, sometimes public facilities, new sewage treatment plants, water facilities. So we don't really have a way that we would say we have a target for how many urban growth boundary expansions we should have, because those expansions are to reflect the local government need. But that's just to show that communities really are actively updating their urban growth boundaries to accommodate housing, employment lands, public facilities, parks, et cetera. Brings us to our key performance measures on public facilities. What we try to measure here are those communities that have up-to-date plans for public facilities and for transportation facilities, and also those communities that have adopted land use policies that are supportive of transit. So looking at multimodal transportation. For public facilities plans, again, we are requesting a methodology change because we see a very different focus depending upon the size of communities that are required to go through periodic review. And this is one where our target is met if we look at those cities larger than 10,000. Again, those cities likely to be experiencing growth, and our target is 70%. And that's what we hit if we use the new metric. Transit supportive use. An example of transit supportive use would be communities that have adopted mixed use zoning around transit stops. So that's an example of how that sort of touches down in communities. This is one where we're doing quite well, and I think this is part speaks to a partnership that we have through our Transportation Growth Management Program with ODOT. Our target here is 88%, and actually received right on the mark. 88% of our cities have those transit supportive land use policies.
Mr. Chair, Carrie, I have a question. Actually, going back to housing, sure. You don't have to go back,
okay.
But just
yep.
To that topic. Yesterday, you mentioned the challenge of affordable housing. And mm-hmm. did you say that you're interested in having a new KPM that would track that, or have you been thinking about? And I assume that is assuming there's a relationship between availability of land and affordable housing. The claim that people make that it's the lack of land that is driving up housing costs. Are you going to be going into that at some point?
Chair Devlin, Senator Dembro, I hadn't planned more remarks on that, so if I could, I will just answer that question now. We are not proposing a new KPM on affordable housing, but we have included as a new strategy in our strategic plan, working with local governments, housing developers, to develop a better understanding of what are the impediments to building affordable housing, sort of across all income, you know, ranges, not just talking about low-income housing, but really workforce housing as well. I think once we do that work, it may be appropriate to add a KPM, but until we know what we're intending to accomplish other than more affordable housing, it's going to be difficult to have a metric that we would propose. I certainly land supply and the cost of land is an issue with land affordability, but there's considerable additional barriers with respect to construction financing, et cetera. So I think what we really want to do in that arena is to develop some improved policies. Once we have improved policies, whether they are a planning process that a local government goes through or some incentives or toolkits that we're able to offer to cities to more efficiently plan for affordable housing, then I think we would be speaking with you all about how we want to measure that, because it is an area where we have frankly not had the success that we would like to see.
And if I may add, we are just entering into an agreement with the planning program at Portland State to actually create an institute of land planning. To do some of the broader policy work, the kind of blue sky thinking that we don't have time for probably isn't appropriate for us to do. And we're proposing that the first project that we work on is, in fact, affordable housing. With housing advocates, we actually have a potential funder of that conversation online, and would hope to get underway by the end of the summer. And I would just expand a little bit on what Carrie was talking about. I think what we really want is an analytical framework that allows us to think through where we have problems bringing affordable housing to the market. And there are lots of inputs other than land. And each of those comes with a cost, whether it's cost of money or whether it's cost of labor or building codes or whatever else. And so we want to be very careful about that analytical framework so that we can then begin to apply it, because there is no place in this state in the regional solutions teams excuse me, that don't point to affordable housing as one of the most critical problems in their region. It's not just Hood River, it's not just Portland, but it's everywhere across the state.
Thank you. If I could just follow up, I really applaud that work. Are you also tracking brownfields conversions? Is that something that you look at? I mean, I know that is one of the goals of, you know, of better use of existing land. It's not a KPM, but I assume it's something you're tracking.
Chair Devlin, Senator Dembro, yes, it is something we're tracking. I could bring those numbers back to the committee. I don't have them at hand now. But, you know, the business community and others certainly point to the impediments that we face in terms of cleaning up those sites. But yet some of those sites are situated close to a workforce, near transportation facilities, already have the other public facilities that would really be helpful to bring them online. And so in that sense, are an underutilized asset. And I'd be happy to bring those numbers back to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay, farm and forest land protection. So this is the outside the urban growth boundary metric. We measure, importantly, the preservation of those resource lands for our commercial farm and forest industries. And the metric we actually use is, what's the percent of farmland that is zoned for exclusive farm use now that had that zoning in 1987? So what is the conversion rate? Our target is that we retain 99% of that zoning. We hit that target on both the forest land side and the farmland side. It's not to say, as we talked about yesterday, that there aren't challenges with land fragmentation or conflicts, but in terms of maintaining the zoning that can be put to that use, we have been successful in doing so. We also measure the impact. A lot of discussions around urban growth boundaries have to do with urban growth boundaries in many places will expand onto farmland. And indeed, for some communities, that's the only place they have to go. Other communities have lower priority lands of rural residential lands and other lands that don't meet the requirements to be zoned for natural resources. We measure each year how the urban growth boundaries have expanded and whether or not they've utilized farmland. So it's a number that can fluctuate depending upon the city you're talking about. Newburgh has exception lands around it. It has opportunities to grow not onto farmland. Woodburn is more constrained. And so the numbers are sometimes going to reflect the geography. Our target there is that we want to add, our target is 55% of the land that's added is not farm and forest land. Our actual numbers are 38%, so somewhat lower. But again, I think this has to be read reflective of the geography that the cities that are expanding their urban growth boundaries.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Do you distinguish between high-value farmland and lesser-value farmland? Is there a gradation there in terms of setting priorities for expansion?
Chair Devlin, Senator Dembro, yes, there is. So there's a prioritization in statute that says when a city is expanding an urban growth boundary, the first place they look are those lands that are not in zone for productive farm or forest use. And then if you need to expand onto lands that are zoned for farm or forest land, you use the least productive lands first. And so there is this prioritization trying to protect that best farmland as sort of our last resort for urban expansion. There are cases where that land is what is appropriate to most appropriate to be used, but then that case needs to be made.
One of the realities in that is that it isn't as if the land outside the urban growth boundary goes in just transitions, so that you might have the less desirable agricultural land a quarter of a mile away from the urban growth boundary and desirable agricultural land in between. Or in the case of a long-standing case that I think now has been resolved in the Hillsborough area, an area of prime agricultural land that is surrounded by three sides by urban development.
Chair Devlin, that's a very important point, because not only do we have those facts on the ground, but we are really trying to create a framework in which cities can grow efficiently. So leapfrogging over prime farmland may, on balance, for the state interest, for the local governments, for the local community's interest, may not be the right choice. And so it is a framework. There are not hard and fast rules, and they are reflective of what the geography and productivity is in the particular area. Our final slide on key performance measures talks, this really does, whereas the others, I said, were proxies or analogs for measuring the outcomes of the program, these are much more directly focused on the performance of the department. So we measure a number of things. As we've talked about, grant awards are a critical part of our program. Therefore, we measure how quickly we get those funds out the door to local governments. And our target is that we get those funds out the door to local governments within 2 months of receiving an application. Our target is 100%. We don't want to set a lower one, but our actual performance is not quite up to that. It's about 80%. We do a lot of work with communities in scoping the contract, making sure that they're going to get a good product out. So some of that delay speaks to real work we're doing with the communities before those grant funds are awarded. Customer service, we measure also those percent of customers rating satisfaction with the agency's service as good or excellent. We're close. Our actual performance is 73%. Our target is 83%. And then finally, just sort of best business practices. How does our commission run in terms of reviewing financial reports, reviewing the doing an evaluation of Director Rue, et cetera? Our target is 100%, and our actual is also 100%. I would, if I could take just a little leave to talk about, and Jim will run through some of this when we talk about our policy option package for increased grant funding. But there are two projects in particular from last year that I think we're really proud of and that speaks to the value of this partnership between the department, oftentimes planning contractors or universities, and local governments. One example I would call out for your attention is a $35,000 grant that was awarded to the city of Tigard. And the purpose of that grant, that as proposed by the city of Tigard, was to assess opportunities for public-private partnerships for infrastructure funding on a prime industrial site. This was a site that was well-situated in every way, about a 40-acre site, except for that it did not have the necessary sewer and water facilities to bring it online. Not only did has the local government worked with the sort of motivated and interested property owner, developers, other consultants to begin a framework for how they can bring public facilities, a funding package to bring public facilities to that property, but in so doing, they also developed a guidebook that can be used by other local governments as they confront that. So it's really a value that that local community provided. And I will give a little shout out. I don't think that last part was actually required as part of our grant product, but it's something that they did as a result. So I think it speaks to how one local government going through the program can actually lift and provide opportunities to others. The second is a farm forest code update. This was a multi-county process that we managed. Almost every session, there are some amendments that are made to the statutes for farm and forest lands and then resulting changes in our rules. And that create some workload for local governments to keep their own local codes up to date. Recognizing that issue and recognizing that many of them are similar changes for counties, we contracted with Angelo Planning Group, created a local advisory committee of a number of county planners, and prepared a model code for farmland, for land zoned for exclusive farm use and for lands zoned for forest use. Reflective of the fact that we actually have different standards depending upon where you are in the state for those, it actually results in three different model codes for farmland and two different model codes for forest land. That model code is then being taken by the counties, and the five counties that are working on that are Union County, Lake County, Coos County, Curry County, and Wasco County. And it's being particularized for that local government. So it's a model code, but then they add their own aspects to it. We will have five counties that are updated as part of that process, and now this model code that can be used by other counties. So it's a way we try to leverage that long-range planning work for the benefit of other communities. With that, I think I will turn it over to Director Rue.
Okay. This is kind of a wonky slide, but it does help introduce the conversation that we're moving into now, which is Governor's recommended budget. So to make some sense of this, look at the four blue boxes in the middle. That is the department. Those are the four things that we primarily do. And I'm not going to read them to you because you're all capable of doing that. But then if you look at the boxes outside of those four, we look at, for instance, on the far right, suppliers. That's you. That's the federal government. That's where we get our money. We look at business drivers on the left side. All of those things that tell us what it is that we ought to be doing with that money, whether it's Oregon state laws, whether it's federal, whether it's executive orders or other requirements of the governor's office, and then, of course, stakeholder needs at the bottom. And then at the top and the bottom, clearly we've got governance and business partners at the top, and we've listed them: the legislature, LCDC, federal, state, tribal governments, cities and counties, and then those people at the bottom that we serve. And again, we consider that we serve clearly you and federal, state, local, tribal government, and citizens and landowners. So that tries to get us down to a single slide. And then keeping that in mind, we can move on to the governor's budget. I would call your attention to the two right-hand columns for comparison. 13-15 legislatively approved budget has general fund of 12.667, and you'll notice that that has gone up by almost exactly 2.4 million dollars. That 2.4 million will be detailed in the POTS that we'll start going through in just a minute. Otherwise, we're pretty flat, except, and I think we pointed this out to each of you when we came around for individual conversations, there's a $500,000 reduction in other funds. That's a reduction of unused limitation. So we're simply removing that. The other funds are, in fact, in the range of $500,000 a year. For the most part, that is money that comes to us from ODOT. It is the money that we use for our Transportation Growth Management Program. It's Federal Highway Administration money to ODOT and then comes to us as other funds. TGM, Transportation Growth Management, is a joint project, jointly managed and staffed by DLCD and ODOT. Just quickly at the bottom, you can see that we're adding four-ish, about 4.5 FTE. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Three of those four are actually jointly managed in the governor's office, in Richard's office, and we'll talk about that in just a second. So these are the POPs, just to get an overview. If you were to add the total value column, you'd come up with more than the 2.4 million that I just told you. It comes to about 260,000 more if you're quickly adding. In our IMMI, our information management initiative, we're self-funding. Excuse me, we're self-funding about half of that 514,000, and actually the next slide goes directly to that. So I don't need to spend any more time on this other than to say that we are making a very concerted effort to try to conserve money where we can when it comes to administrative overhead and move that money into the field or into, in this case, analytics and measurement. And so this is a very intentional move on our part to either share staff with other agencies, to try to cut staff. One of the areas, for instance, that allowed us to accumulate this 247,000 was letting go of our halftime contracts person and actually setting up an arrangement with Water Resources where they are on a retainer for us. We give them $10,000, we work it down. They do our contracting, and when we then need to refill that pot, we do. But it comes at a dramatic savings over carrying somebody on our headcount. We've done the same with our payroll person. We don't have one. We use ags. And we're now, in fact, in the transition, ag and ourselves are going to be using ODF&Ws. So we compensate them for the work that they do, but we don't have to carry a person and all of the extra overhead, but we simply pay for the service. Quickly, 10% reduction. If you glance back very quickly at general fund, and I will do it for you, you don't have to do it. Our general fund ask is roughly $15 million. So 10% of that is $1.5 million. It gets broken into a 5% and 10% reduction plan. We have the detail. It's in the large book that we sent you some time ago. I think it's under tab J. I would just say qualitatively, other than the numbers, which of course add to 1.5 million, that we're really trying to, again, focus on those areas that maybe tend to be more administrative. We stay away from where we can field staff. We said this yesterday. We tend to stay away from program staff, and we tend to stay away from general fund grants because those are our priorities, and we just continue to find other places, and frankly to try to carefully excuse me this morning. We try to carefully manage any vacancy savings that we get during the course of the biennium. So I think that takes us directly to our first POP 101. Governor's recommended budget has a $500,000 increase in it. I don't think you have it in your package, but you're going to have to trust me on this. In 07-09, our total excuse me, our total general fund grant amount was $2.7 million. Our ask in total for the upcoming biennium is just over $2 million. So we're still down 700,000 from where we were just before the recession. But we are trying to claw our way back. And so in 07-09, we had the 2.7. In 9/11, we lost about 500,000. In 11-13, we lost another 700,000. And again, just to remind you, that's money that goes directly to local governments. No overhead taken by the department. It goes directly through to local governments to fund their planning. So that's the purpose of the $500,000 ask. The average general fund technical assistance grant is about $30,000 to $35,000. So that $500,000 can get us somewhere between 10 and 15 additional cities that can do an economic opportunity analysis, can do a housing analysis, can do other updates to their plans so that, again, they're ready for growth. And I don't know that I need to say anything else about that. It's just money that we hope you hear tomorrow in stakeholder and public testimony, money that is well used by local governments in which they have come to depend. Next slide simply shows you, if you look at the counties that have a box around their name, so Umatilla in the east, Tillamook in the far west, and some others, those are counties to whom we have given grant money. The stars are cities to whom we have given grant money in the last biennium, and then you see there are also, well, it says ports. Oh, it's the Port of Portland. Mm-hmm. Some money to the Port of Portland, actually. There was, some of you may have heard of this or actually seen the document that came out of, there was a multi-agency public-private effort to take a look at industrial lands inventory in Portland. The port was one of the primary authors. We gave them some money to do that because clearly it's helpful to everybody to have real data and not just anecdotes. I think it's Carrie's turn again.
Okay, turning to POP 104, this is our Information Management Modernization Initiative. It's part, and as Jim referred to earlier, we've self-funded a portion of this, so it's a $513,000 total project cost, but I think about 240, if I have my numbers about right, is a portion that we are self-funding internally in the department through some reallocation internally of funds. This was a five-year plan of the department to really modernize our information structure so that our staff could access the data that we do have and collect better. We could improve our workflow internally in the department. We could provide more resources. We have a number of documents and things, but they have become structured in a way where it's hard to sort of push out and provide that information to local governments and also improve the ability to provide that to the public. So we are, this next biennium would end up funding projects years 4 and 5 of that initiative. And we do have both staffing as a component of that. So right now we have a half-time limited duration database manager. This package would end up with a result of a full-time permanently funded database administrator. I think that position is really critical. When we've built information assets in the department over time, unless we have somebody who can keep them up to date, extract the reports that we need, build on that resource, it ends up becoming antiquated over time. And so if you were to ask me, what is the way that you stay modern and you stay up to date? Well, a primary way that we will be doing that is by having a database administrator to manage these assets for us. Talk a little bit about the goals of this project, because they speak to a number of themes that Jim and I have identified. Again, as I said, one is to improve internal DLCD workflow. Two, to improve policymaking, making us and our commission and the public have more ready access to the data on which we can base policy decisions. Three, to ease the reporting requirements from local governments. In Appendix G of your materials is a farm forest report that we're required to do on an annual basis. We've brought that system online for local governments, really reducing the amount of time that they need to spend giving us that data, improves their time, makes the data more readily available for us. And then fourth, to improve the data and resources available to local governments and the public. And we've done that in part by partnering with the Institute for Natural Resources at OSU in the Oregon Explorer to make that as a landing place for people who are interested in land use planning documents. You can find mapping, you can find documents, et cetera. And we actually have a brief video that I'll show you at the end that sort of walks you through a little bit of the information that's available on that site. So in this past year, we redid our farm and forest database, and we brought it online so that local governments can input the data directly into our system. Saves the local government's time, certainly saves them time, costs of postage and printing and copying things for us, improves the quality of our data. There are required fields that the local government fills out. We now have all the data that we need instead of needing to call them back if there was a blank that they, you know, inadvertently missed, et cetera. So it's both both qualitative and quantitative in terms of the improvements there. We're doing the same thing with the post-acknowledgement plan amendments. Local governments are required to submit those to us. We now have electronic submission, and soon they'll be able to enter the data for those submission online as well. Just more efficient, more modern, more constructive for all parties. We've partnered with the University of Oregon Planners Library to provide electronic copies of all of our planning documents that we receive from local governments. So from 2006 on, we have electronic files. And one of the projects we'll be doing next year is to bring more of those historical files online. But those make them available, searchable to whether it's a property owner, a local government, a member of the public, et cetera. And then finally, one other project we worked on last year that I would highlight is serving as stewards for some framework GIS data that's available on the web. So these include floodplain maps, urban growth boundaries, city limits. Our state partners, such as ODOT, use those for transportation modeling. Our local governments can use those. We've also developed a statewide framework for a baseline zoning map across the state for both counties and cities. That's a complicated process because, as we've talked to you about before, all cities have different zoning designations and different names they may use. So we need some way of synthesizing this, but I think it's important from the state output to be able to look at that as a glance. So with that, I'd like to show you this video, and let's see if I can do it well. It's about 4 minutes, and I think worth the – oops, that's not where I go.
Welcome to this video introduction to the land use planning information that will be available through the redesigned Oregon Explorer site. The Oregon Explorer Digital Library, a partnership between the Institute for Natural Resources and the Oregon State University Library, is undergoing a redesign to combine the existing portals into a single, integrated, comprehensive site. The redesigned Oregon Explorer will launch in June of 2015 and will include the tools and resources shown here. We worked with the Department of Land Conservation and Development to put together information to support land use planners, including acknowledged planning documents, statewide guidance documents, and mapping tools. The land use page brings together the various content types. Users can search the acknowledged local and regional planning documents from this page, or click the Planning Resources tab.
Sorry if that's making you a little dizzy.
When you search the local documents by entering your city, county, or region of interest, you can further refine the search by document type once the results appear. On the left-hand panel above, users can search statewide guidance documents and web pages. Over 250 resources were assembled with the input of DLCD and sorted by the topic they relate to. These topics align with the planning goals, although some goals have been combined into one topic, and a topic was added for Measure 49. You can also filter these results by content type. Most of these resources come directly from DLCD, and those from external agencies or organizations have been recommended by DLCD and are clearly marked with their source name. This is the first time planners have been able to search electronic local planning documents and statewide guidance documents from one centralized location. This project also created a series of maps and tools. First, we'll look at the zoning map. This map shows the zoning map service coming from DLCD, who are the state stewards for the GIS element zoning layer. Once you've searched for your place, you can view zoning in that area. Clicking on the map shows the zoning, and clicking that result shows the details of the zoning. Next, we'll look at the urban growth boundary history map. This map brings in a map service from DLCD showing urban growth boundary change through time. We're going to zoom into the Portland area because it can be hard to see urban growth boundary change at the statewide scale because it's so localized. Clicking the play button at the bottom animates the urban growth boundary change through time.
It's a slow time sequence though.
The next map we'll look at is the Planning's Map Viewer. Planner's Map Viewer brings together map services identified by DLCD as important to land use planners. Framework map services come from DAS-GEO, and landslide and fault information comes from Dogami. We also brought in relevant federal services, such as the National Conservation Easement Database. Bringing together existing map services keeps information under the control of the data providers to facilitate seamless data updates. Finally, we'll show you the Oregon Explorer Atlas. The idea of the Atlas is to allow users to easily view a map and a chart for a particular place. We strove to make the interface simple and intuitive. Users select their place of interest on the right and choose a layer on the left. So in this case, we're going to look at Coos Bay, and we're going to look at 100-year floodplain. The chart on the left shows that 40.91% of Coos Bay is in the 100-year floodplain, which ranks 18 out of 377 for this place type, so among other cities in this case. We'll also look at landslide deposits and scarps. So in this case, you can see a count of the historically active landslides. There are 5 within Coos Bay, And you can also see the percent of the area that is covered by landslide deposits. We are also going to develop summaries for the following thematic areas, including employment, education, soils information, threatened and endangered species, and wetlands. The resources and tools we developed with DLCD, shown here today, will be publicly available when the redesigned Oregon Explorer launches in June of this year.
Okay, thank you. In this next year, we will essentially build upon the tools and applications that serves all aspects of our priorities for this project, and really, as I say, brings the information to the public, to our local government partners, to our state agency partners in the land use planning program. I appreciate INR sort of speeding up their process. You can say you saw the premiere here first. The website is not yet active, but will be as indicated in June. So we really wanted to show you how we are attempting to collect the data and how we're bringing this to local governments. And with that, I will end my discussion of this POP.
Okay, POP 106.
Let's get this right. Sorry. Thank you.
This is not an ad to our general fund request. This is a continuation in the last biennium. This was limited duration. And so our ask here is to convert this to permanent funds. The program is now at the end of its second year, working to help communities find ways to reduce greenhouse gases from transportation. Transportation accounts for, depending upon the area in the state, somewhere around 35% of the total budget for greenhouse gas emissions on any given period of time. And so we are working with communities across the state, primarily through metropolitan planning organizations for larger cities, to help them, for the most part, voluntarily do this work. I say for the most part because Metro is required to adopt a greenhouse gas reduction plan. The other seven MPOs in the state are not required to, so it is purely voluntary, and that's the work that we do, is trying to take lessons learned from Metro and share them with those other metropolitan planning organizations. And for the most part, with the exception of Bend, they are on the west side from Salem down to Grants Pass in Medford.
POP 107 relating to natural hazards is both a continuation and an addition of some limited continuation of limited duration funding from last session, and then an addition of a half-time FTE. The goal here is quite simple, as illustrated on the slide, to improve natural hazards mitigation planning in Oregon. The package proposes to do this in two ways. One, to develop an analytic framework that combines the best hazards data we have available with data about vulnerability of the population and infrastructure, and try to do that in a more localized manner so that each community has a better understanding of the risks they face, the vulnerabilities, and the consequences of those, so that when they're doing their natural hazards actual planning, it reflects those relative risks. The other part of the package is to continue funding for the Department of Land Conservation and Development to be the coordinating agency to develop the federally required natural hazard mitigation plan at the state level that's required by FEMA. We did that in this last go-around, and we propose to continue that work together with OPRD at University of Oregon and Office of Emergency Management at the state and other partners such as Dogami, et cetera, that all really feed into that state plan.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
This is a subject of a lot of interest for me. You know, just I think we're all aware that, you know, in light of climate change, we need to do a lot more resiliency planning and adaptation. And a lot of that will have to happen at the local level. So, I think this is really important, this kind of investment. But it seems to me somehow we need to get dollars into the field as well. And I wonder if you could talk about how your efforts can help leverage that, or is it going to require a direct appropriation from the legislature?
Chair Devlin and Senator Dembro, I think you've piqued both Jim's and my interest, so I think we might both be contributing to the answer to this question. So one way, the halftime FTE is actually a planner who can work directly with local governments about how to develop those natural hazard mitigation plans at the local level and provide that technical assistance. So that's one part of it. It's getting planning assistance out to those communities. Another way that I will use it that we have done working with Dogami in the Clackamas County area, they did some landslide mapping. Then our department has worked with Clackamas County to apply that to their local codes, and then we're taking that as the basis for developing a model code that again can be used as sort of the foundation for a local government to begin to approach that. So I would say yes. We in our one of the reasons why we ask for more money in general fund grants is in part to dedicate some towards natural hazards planning. The other way we try to do that is to match those dollars with technical and planning expertise in the department and the development of model codes so that we can bring as many assets to the local government in doing their planning as possible. I suspect much more is needed. This is what we've asked for in this biennium.
And I would just add that of the 466, roughly 200 of that goes to a risk assessment tool that is underway and in development at the University of Oregon. It actually looks at particularly landslide risk around the state of Oregon, does a relative risk analysis so that we know where to put our money first, and certainly in those areas that are of highest risk to communities. The next three, POPs 108, 109, and 502, are all three joint POPs between ourselves and the Governor's Natural Resources Office. So Richard has claim on a good bit of this money, but we're working together on these projects. So $438,000 for SageCon. We talked a fair bit about this yesterday, but if you look closely at the map and count, there are six counties that are affected dramatically by core habitat of sage grouse, heavily concentrated in the two counties of Harney and Malheur. So this is one person plus money to be working with the counties to make sure that they're headed in the same direction on their Goal 5 inventories to protect habitat. And then of this, there's also 100,000. So the person and expenses comes to 338,000, and then there's 100,000 of this that is set aside specifically for general fund grants to the counties. So to help support them in their planning effort. We had hoped to be able to get Judge Grasty he's not going to be able to drive over, but we'd hope to be able to get him to call in tomorrow, and instead he's going to submit a letter. I cannot say enough positive about Judge Grasty and his leadership efforts on pulling together this cooperative relationship between the six counties, the state, and ultimately the federal government to make sure that we can hold off a listing. We believe that the state of Oregon can manage this and preserve natural resources without negatively affecting the economies of these six counties. But you can see that particularly in Harney, Malheur, and Baker, it's going to be a big task. And so that's where this money's headed. One thing I want to notice for you, this says this is permanent. The PF up there is permanent funding. In fact, it is LD. So that's just a typo. Then if there are no questions. Moving on to 109, so-called environmental solutions. This, again, is jointly administered between ourselves and Richard's office. Once again, the PF should say LD. And again, so it's a typo. Our portion, so there's two people. Our portion of these two people, half of each of them, so a composite of one, will be working with Business Oregon. And I mentioned this to you briefly yesterday. We asked for five positions to do non-regulatory community development work to help rural communities around the state get started on economic development in their own communities. Three of those positions will be at Business Oregon and will be in their request. One of them is here. One of them is in Richards. Richards is to work on some big projects, and the one that quickly comes to mind is Jordan Cove. Jordan Cove is an incredibly complex project involving state departments, Oregon state departments, federal government, local government, and so one of those positions in Richard's office would seek to coordinate and head up big energy projects in particular, such as Jordan Cove. So unless there are questions on that one, I think we'll move on to 502.
502 is also part of an initiative that Richard Whitman came and spoke with this committee about in outlining the governor's objectives. Our component, sort of rightly so, is to look at how we can assist in the preservation of the land base that's necessary to have robust agriculture and forest economy to retain those parts of our work. So one particular area of focus for this position would be in doing outreach to forest and farmland owners, looking at, again, non-regulatory tools that we can layer over our statewide land use planning program, such as the transfer of development rights, to bring money to farmers and timberland owners to protect those lands long term for agriculture and forestry use. They'll also be looking at finance tools, other programs jointly, again, with the GNRO office, the Governor's Natural Resource Office, and our sister agencies of Department of Forestry and Department of Agriculture.
I had a question about this. I've had a number of discussions with different parties on this, both in the executive branch and outside the executive branch. And Mr. Whitman admits that this is a pilot project. And while I can see the benefits for some of the finance tools, and there is actually a significant ask beyond this in terms of capital.
Yes.
As a pilot, it's affordable. As a practice, I don't know how it would ever be affordable under our current budget restraints. I mean, in a sense, you're subsidizing, in a sense, a party being productive, a productive rate of return. The financing isn't really that, but I mean, the financing is actually allowing people to, retain land or expand their holdings with a longer-term expectation of returns, but actually providing, in a sense, almost like permanent subsidies to make agriculture and timberlands viable. I just don't know how it would fit within the state's current revenue realities.
Jim may want to add more. You want to? I have one comment, just Chair Devlin, with respect to the transfer development right program aspect that we have envisioned at the department, and we've actually just adopted rules for this relative to Measure 49. development opportunities, home sites that were authorized under Measure 49, to look at where some of those home site authorizations are. Maybe they are in very high quality, maybe habitat. Maybe they're in a floodplain or a floodway where we prefer not to see additional development. Maybe they're on high-value farmland, and we'd like to direct some of that development someplace else. So what we've done with that program is to enable a landowner to transfer that development right to another location. I think that's what we would be exploring. Well, I know that's what we would be exploring in our aspect of this initiative. Which in an ideal world, but this is why it's a pilot project, would be a relatively low cost, because we wouldn't be buying those development rights that someone might have. We'd rather be transferring those to a different location, so that there would be a bit of a private market or a private transfer of those rights. That only speaks to your long-term concerns about one aspect of this program. I absolutely acknowledge that. It's also something we still think is appropriate to do in a pilot perspective, because we need to be able to measure its success, be able to build off of some of the work we did in the Measure 49 arena, but there's more work to do. I don't know, Jim, if you want to speak to the larger, or if you can speak to the larger budget package.
Well, yeah, Chair Devlin, you alluded to it, and just perhaps to put much too fine a point on it, I'm going to use my own family as an example. My brother and I are both in our 60s. We have a farm interest that we clearly want to transfer to our kids, and we want it to remain in working farm. And so we're fortunate enough that we've made plans for that transition, and it's underway. But there are a lot of individual farm operations around the state who simply have not been able to do that tax planning, that ownership planning. And so part of the financing package that you refer to clearly goes to help that transition from this huge cohort of 60, 70-year-old farmers who want to transfer the land to their kids and keep it in working farms. It also means that there's the possibility, the likelihood, that non-farmers are going to be moving into that market. And the barriers to entry of buying farmland, equipment, and getting going are huge. And so to the point for the financing package, I'm convinced that there's a real need if we're going to keep this land in productive ag. The LD portion of this, as you can see, a lot of this work happens with extension. Ag extension is getting cut back on a fairly regular basis. Some of it is just not done, and it's work that I think that we need to do, focusing on those farmers that are kind of struggling to stay in business.
Well, I think it's simply, I think it has lofty goals. But I'm looking at sort of the bottom line, and I compare it to like the language, it's not your department, but the language in the governor's budget relative to water resources and becoming a major water resources provider and builder of major infrastructure, where specific projects like some of those in the Umatill or Deschutes make sense. But just this overall statement that somehow we are going to become this mega builder.
Yeah.
When I know what our debt capacity is over the next 10 years, and we are far overstrained even on what limited debt capacity we have with our current requirements.
So, and you're absolutely correct. The only thing that I would say about the infrastructure of water is that until the last decade or so, we had God's own infrastructure. In mid-level yeah. snowpack. I do not know what we're going to do this coming summer, either in terms of fire or some continuous operation of ag. because our reservoirs are gone. And the only hope we have of continuing irrigated ag in big parts of this state is storage, harvesting winter flows. Yeah. So. But I get your point. Okay. Totally.
Okay. So I better want to get back.
Yeah. No, and we told you we'd try to wrap this up in an hour. We're already 9 minutes over time. We're losing people.
What a cue.
I'm so sorry.
To the two of you walking out the door. But we do want to wrap this up.
Yeah, we have actually just, we're about two or three slides from doing so. I won't belabor our legislative proposals. We talked to, I think, with each one of you individually. These are really fall under technical adjustments to bills that were passed in prior sessions concerning our urban growth boundary streamlining bill. That's the first one, our urban growth boundary straddle parcels. Happy to go into detail, but this just allows those lands that are brought into urban growth boundaries to be divided off the farm parcel that stays outside so that the portion that's inside the urban growth boundary can be developed, and we needed to make that technical adjustment. And then there was mapping identification errors, or I won't quite call them legal description errors, in House Bill 4078 from last session, that given the rate of speed with which that was adopted, not surprisingly, there are a few things to tidy up. So those are, I think, have all maybe moved out of the House at this point, and will be coming over to this side of the dais soon. We have broad support for them. Some of them are done at the request of local governments, but that's a pretty modest legislative package for us this session.
So from here on, we're.
I want you to note that the Senate is very attentive.
Still here. We're still here.
It's all the case.
For the three. Yeah. I want to spend just a moment talking about this because I think that you've probably heard about it from other natural resource agencies. I can't speak to how non-natural resource agencies are doing this. We like to remember that we have the benefit of 20-plus years of working as a cabinet and know each other's programs and personnel really well. But one of the things that we're recognizing, and I'm going to use human resources as an example because we have a study group for HR right now. We recognize that there is a full inventory of needs that we have for HR. It's not just hiring people and the occasional letting people go, but it also means investing in our employees and doing training and employee development. It means, frankly, having a place where an aggrieved employee can go, shut the door, talk to the HR professional, knowing that it's not ever going to go outside of that office. It's just a place to let off some steam. And as it turns out, not every single agency has that full inventory of capacity. So what we're doing is assembling a group of about six agencies, and we're doing an inventory of capacity on one hand, and we're doing an inventory of needs and requests on the other, and then we're just doing the cross-matching. So this is not hiring new people. This is not spending money that we don't have or asking for new money to spend. It is simply an attempt to use the resources that we have scattered among agencies to serve all of those agencies better. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. We, DLCD, do not have a payroll clerk. We're working through, or I think we said it this morning earlier, we're working through Ag and now Department of Fish and Wildlife to provide payroll. So we pay for the service. We don't carry the overhead. We're obviously doing the same with our contracts person. We're sharing our HR capacity and have with Ag for the last 4 years. So we're just, this slide only talks about ongoing efforts to try to share capacity among agencies so that we get more without having to spend more. And then, since we are 13 minutes and 35 seconds beyond what we said we would do, you tell me. We can go through some of these technical adjustments. We have lists of people we hired above step two. We can talk about. It's your call.
Well, Representative Rayfield tomorrow can. How long would this take tomorrow morning?
5 minutes easily.
Okay. I mean, well, you'll be here tomorrow morning
yes.
for the public
Absolutely.
Testimony.
Yep.
So I think he can cover this first before we go into the public testimony, because
okay,
even
that's
with
fine.
Public testimony, the hearing tomorrow probably won't take an hour.
It so. Will not.
No, it should not.
Okay. I'm so expecting 8 or 10 people.
Okay. With that, you're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.